Kristen Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
Let's get right to it. Joining us on the line from Rome is Chris Livesay. He's a reporter for ANSA. That's the Italian news agency that broke the story of Pope Benedict stepping down. Chris, welcome back on day two of the Great Papal Chimney Watch.
Thanks for having me.
You know, before we get started, to put people in the proper mindset, here is what we in America, and I guess around the world, have been listening to nonstop for the past day.
There was a little bit of question about whether we were seeing this morning white smoke or black smoke. I can show you a couple of the images we received this morning were rather ambiguous.
We can see the first smoke signal coming out at 7:41. It is obviously a black smoke, which means that no pontiff has been elected yet.
As we look at the Sistine Chapel, black smoke now pouring from the chimney below the cardinals, this indicating they have taken their first vote as they seek to elect a new pope.
Okay. I could listen to that all day long, I have to say.
So I guess the score at this point, Chris, is we've got three votes, black smoke down, and two more votes to go this afternoon, correct?
That's right.
When this afternoon? We don't know.
Well, we don't know exactly when they're going to finish. In fact, that's something that that Father Lombardi, the head Vatican spokesman, made a point of saying today in the afternoon press conference. People were concerned. They wanted to know if he could be more precise, and he said, "You're asking me things that only God knows," and that's why these cardinals are locked away. We don't know exactly what's going on in there. We can only presume, and that smoke signal, this holy smoke signal is our only indication of once their vote is done.
You know, my favorite thing this morning was listening to the radio and television with the nervous anchor saying, it's definitely black. Well, wait a second. It's sort of charcoal gray. And hey, Chris, I'm embarrassed I don't know the answer to this. In between ballots, in between votes, what do the 115 cardinals do?
They do normal things. Mostly they eat. You know, they have their meals. In between, they congregate. There's a chapel where they can go and contemplate and pray. So it's pretty normal, although they're, of course, locked away. They don't have telephones. They don't have cell phones. No TVs. They're completely shut off from the outside world. In fact, to be extra careful, the Vatican has installed an electric fence. That sounds pretty foreboding, but let me explain. It's a signal blocking fence that prevents anything from coming in and anything from coming out. So nobody with a high-powered radar, for instance, could aim its sights on the Sistine Chapel and try and get some whispers of who the next pope might be.
So, what I meant was, in addition to that, the more mundane things, can Cardinal O'Malley go over to Cardinal Dolan and say, hey, who'd you vote for in the last ballot? What do you think of Shearer from Brazil? Or can they do that? Can they do the politicking thing?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are some provisions laid out that forbid certain things like trying to establish a ticket or promising votes. You're not supposed to be securing votes at all, but those rules are known to be massaged. They're sort of elastic. So we do know that, yeah, these cardinals do talk amongst themselves. And today, in the briefing, Lombardi said that there is talking, but you know, it's very discreet. You won't hear any loud conversations. It's all said in very hushed tones. So yeah, there is some, for lack of a better word, politicking going on. Although I know the Vatican would not describe it as such. Mm-hmm. They say this is the Holy Spirit moving through these men of the Church, and their vote is just an extension of the Holy Spirit.
Well, Chris, before we get back to the hometown boy, Sean O'Malley, there are some doubts, serious questions about the two supposed frontrunners at this point, Scola from Milan and Cher from Brazil. What are those doubts?
Yeah, these are pretty interesting. They also, both of them had doubts raised right before going into the conclave. The most visible one had to do with Scola. He's the Archbishop of Milan, and he comes from the same town as a guy named Roberto Formigoni. He is the governor, the outgoing governor of the Lombardy region, who has a long track record of allegations of corruption. In fact, he's right now under investigation for taking bribe money, essentially, from a lobbyist. It's something he flatly profuse. But in any event, he's linked to Scola. And in the morning of the conclave, police, actually it was anti-mafia police, who launched a series of raids into the healthcare sector of the region of Lombardy. Now, it's all, you know, very convoluted, as these things in Italian politics tend to be. Scola is not directly implicated, so it's guilt by association. But there's another layer to this too. Both Scola and Formigoni are members of a group that's called Communion and Liberation, and it dates back to the 60s. It's very pro-evangelization. It encourages members to evangelize in schools, the workplace, etc. It's very conservative. It has very close ties to Italian politics. The group over the past two decades has strongly supported former Premier Silvio Berlusconi. So there has been a lot of talk that the Cardinals are going to raise questions of Scola's membership in this group. Now, he's no longer a member of the group, but for many years he was strongly promoting it. The group was strongly promoted also by Benedict, by John Paul II, and there are enough cardinals now who are saying anonymously, this is, of course, right before the conclave, that this is an issue for them. They don't want somebody with a political agenda leading the Catholic Church.
You know, Chris Livesay from ANSA, the Italian news agency, this is actually what I was trying to get to before, and I couldn't articulate it. So if you say they're going to raise issues, concerns about Scola's potential connections to this, is that something a cardinal can stand up in the Sistine Chapel and say, well, I have great respect for my brother, or whoever they refer to each other, for His Holiness Angelo Scola, I think we should all have some concern about the implications of this. Can they do that in the conclave, or is that prohibited as well?
Well, it's definitely not the norm. In fact, typically those types of speeches are only made if there's a deadlock in the voting. So if we're looking at, you know, a week of protracted voting, right, and still no one's moved on this, then there are some rules in the book of the conclave that does allow for certain speeches to be made. And those speeches, you know, this is all cloaked in secrecy, of course, and so we don't know exactly what one could expect in this type of a speech. But it's supposed to prompt people to look ahead and say, these are the issues. Typically, you would say, okay, we've got, you know, this person, maybe you've got, 40 votes for one candidate and 40 for another, but it's just not moving anywhere. The person making the speech would try and prompt people to vote in one direction or another.
Understood.
Chris, I wonder, the two supposed front runners, you mentioned Scola with these political problems, perhaps, and there's also some problem with Scherer, the cardinal from Brazil. What's the deal with him?
Right. So Scherer is from the Curia originally. Before he became the Archbishop of San Paolo, he was a member of the Curia, and that's the administrative body within the Vatican. So people who are looking for a reformist touch inside the Vatican are starting to wonder about how effective he might be, especially because of his ties to the Vatican Bank. The Vatican Bank, also known as the Institute for Religious Works, has a troubled history. Its director was ousted in a very unorthodox move last year over allegations of money laundering. In fact, it was 30 million euros of money that the Vatican Bank was keeping in an outside account that was frozen by banking officials in Italy. It was eventually released. But for a long time, the Vatican has been trying to overcome this reputation to get on the so-called white list of banks with a clean record. And so many people are wondering now, you know, if having somebody like Scherer in the papacy would help them overcome this reputation.
You know, it sounds like the Republican and National Democratic Convention.
Worse. Chris Livesay, lobbyists and payoffs and everything else.
We've shown great restraint not talking about Sean O'Malley for about 7 minutes with you. Before we do, though, by the way, obviously all the talk in the papers here is O'Malley, is the boomlet real? And then there's Cardinal Dolan from New York City. We're all familiar with O'Malley. Very few of us have any familiarity with Dolan. So what some of our colleagues have put together is we're first going to listen to Cardinal O'Malley's style responding to Benedict stepping down. And then we'll listen to Cardinal Dolan from New York. about how he responded to both that and the obligation to pick the next pope. First, O'Malley.
Although I trust the discernment and wisdom of Pope Benedict, I am saddened at the prospect of losing his eloquent clarity in preaching the gospel to us. In these days, there will be endless speculation about candidates and outcomes. I assure you, no cardinal goes into the conclave with the ambition of being chosen.
Well, no
wow.
William Jennings Bryan there.
Now, here's great.
Here's Cardinal Dolan on NBC's Today Show talking about virtually the same stuff.
I'm still unpacking the red socks from a year ago when I was made a cardinal. So this is going to be, I'm going to need some coaching here. And I don't exactly know, except for prayer, I don't know what else to do. I'll await instructions with everybody else.
As a cardinal, are you allowed to vote for yourself?
No, only crazy people cannot enter the contract.
And Dolan is a great blogger. Here's one of his great lines from over there in Rome. So far, I've been unable to find an Irish brown bread, corned beef, or whiskey. I mean, he is pretty funny. He did a stand-up with Stephen Colbert at Fordham University in the fall.
So you have Cardinal O'Malley and you have Cardinal Henny Youngman, for lack of a better expression, Dolan from New York City. You know, as an outsider and as a non-Catholic, I can't imagine these 115 rather elderly gentlemen saying that Dolan is the kind of person that they want to be the face of the church, even though as an outsider, I think it would be electric. What's the word on the street in Rome, Chris Livesay?
Well, you cited John Allen yesterday, the respected American Vaticanist, and his response to Dolan was, if he does become pope, all the rest of the world's bishops may as well take the next few years off because
great,
they
yeah.
will get no more airtime, no attention whatsoever. He's such a charismatic personality. Camera loves him. He's a great joke teller. So that's what you're in for. I think that there are a lot of cardinals who would enjoy hearing from this guy for the next few years. But then there are the others who would be worried about being completely overshadowed and having their message be lost.
You know, in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to someone in studio here about March Madness of the basketball variety. Is there March Madness of the papal variety amongst all you journalists over there in Rome? I mean, no, I'm serious. Is there like, are there office pools where Chris Livesay and John Allen and all these people make their picks as to who the next pope is going to be? You do that, don't you?
Yeah, not just we among the journalists, but regular people do. You hear talk about it everywhere. You know, just riding the bus back from the Vatican a few minutes ago, I was standing next to three police officers. And, you know, these three guys were talking about who they wanted to see become pope. One was talking about how it would be great to have Scherer as pope because of all the beautiful Brazilian women that would start flocking to
that's right.
to the town.
Gisele Bündchen. She's from Brazil. I think she's from where he
that's
is,
right?
Yeah.
Well, so there you go. She might be buying a plane ticket sometime soon. And that's the way a lot of these people make these choices, not always spiritual ones, more mercenary in some cases.
Well, Chris, thanks.
Chris, thank you so much. And I'm hoping that I'm getting impatient. I want there to be a...
Stay tuned, Marjorie.
I know,
get a rest.
I want it to happen this afternoon. But thank you very much, Chris Livesay, a reporter with...
Thanks for having me.
Talk to you tomorrow, Chris.
Great, fun to talk to. He's with the news agency that broke the story of the Pope resigning. And again, Chris, thank you very much.
Do you remember that great story? We should just say again, if you weren't listening yesterday, the reason his colleague from ANSA broke the story is because Benedict resigned in Latin.
And
while a lot of the cardinals don't speak Latin, and most of the reporters didn't, this reporter for ANSA did speak Latin.
That's right.
And that's why she got the
scoop. It was
great.
Pretty neat. Next week, as many of you know, marks the 10th year anniversary of the war in Iraq. Coming up, we're going to talk to journalist and filmmaker Sebastian Younger about the meaning of war and life on the front lines. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. As you know, it's been almost a decade since America invaded Iraq. At GBH, we're taking stock of these 10 years this Friday night with a panel of journalists who know the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan the way only an embedded journalist can. Joining us from New York is one of those journalists, Sebastian Younger. He embedded with troops in Afghanistan. That became the stuff of his book War and his award-winning documentary Restrepo. Sebastian Younger, thank you for joining us and welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So tell people who don't know, Sebastian, you spent nearly a year over there embedded with the troops in Afghanistan. Where were you and what was it like?
Well, I picked one platoon, which is about 30 men. They were in the Korangal Valley of eastern Afghanistan in Kunar province. And I followed them off and on for a year. I couldn't stay there the whole time. I really actually would have liked to, but I couldn't. I did 5 one-month trips. And my colleague, Tim Hetherington, who is also shooting video for the documentary that I made, Restrepo, he did 5 one-month trips. So, and often we were apart, so we covered quite a lot of territory. And there was a lot of combat there. We were at a 20-man outpost on a ridge. No internet, no phone, no electricity for a while, no running water, no cooked food, no women out there, no television, absolutely nothing except an enormous amount of combat. Something like a fifth of all the combat in all of Afghanistan for a while was happening in this six-mile-long Korangal Valley.
You know, you grew up on the, I guess, the not-so-mean streets of Belmont, and then you end up in one of the most dangerous places on earth in eastern Afghanistan. How do you decide to put yourself in harm's way like that, you and Tim? And by the way, for those who don't know, Tim obviously was killed. Where was it, in Libya in 2011? Was that the year, 2011, Sebastian?
That's right. He died almost 2 years ago in Libya.
How'd you decide to put yourself at that kind of risk, Sebastian?
I wanted to be a war reporter, and I don't think the risks are that high, actually, and they seem manageable. I used to be a climber for tree companies before I was a war reporter, and it's sort of the same thing. Like, if you do the job, I mean, you can always fall out of a tree and get yourself killed, but if you do the job well and thoughtfully, you don't fall out of a tree, and I sort of approach journalism the same way.
But it is one of the, when I said before,
dangerous.
I wasn't trying to be overly hyperbolic. This is one of the most dangerous places on earth, is it not?
Well, I've covered a lot of wars, and most of the time I've been with militia forces or whatever, or just with the civilian population. If you get wounded, there's no combat medic there. There's no one to help you. You're really on your own. When you're with American forces, it's really kind of a luxury. You really feel like if you get hit, there's a medic there. You're going to get medevaced by helicopter. Like, the machine's going to kick into gear to take care of you, and that's tremendously reassuring. And it makes embedded reporting, even in a lot of combat, feel way easier than being on your own in an African civil war, for example.
Well, you know, I don't mean to be so picky, but when I read about the tarantulas and the fleas, Sebastian, I mean, this was your fellow soldiers or the soldiers that you covered, because they had gotten so thin, smelling like ammonia because they were burning muscle instead of fat, this was a physically really difficult environment.
Oh, it was absolutely difficult. I just didn't think I was going to get killed out there, although I almost was. But physically, it was very, very hard. I mean, you know, you're carrying, the soldiers are carrying upwards of 100 pounds on a combat patrol. And as a journalist, you're probably carrying half that. And it's very steep mountains. And, it was miserable. Physically, it was absolutely miserable. Yes, you're right.
Okay. One of the things you have written about is just the difficulty of soldiers coming back to the United States and resuming their civilian life. And you wrote a lot about this Sergeant Brian O'Byrne, who at one point said he missed being there. How's he doing?
Brendan O'Byrne, yeah.
Brendan O'Byrne, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. He's doing quite well. I actually trained him how to work as a climber for tree companies, and that's how he's making his living for a while. We're very good friends. He's living in Massachusetts. He does quite a bit of public speaking about veterans' issues and about the war. So he's really doing very well. And I should say that he wasn't sort of the oddball in the platoon or kind of missed that year, as hard as it was. A lot of the guys in the platoon really – I mean, I would say most of the platoon, after they got back from the Korangal, in one form or another, they said to me, you know, like, we'd go back there in a heartbeat if we could.
And a lot of them did go back. Didn't a lot of them re-up, and a lot of them wanted to be there? Is that because of the camaraderie? Was it because of the addiction to danger? Why did they want to be back in this place?
Yeah, most of them re-upped. Brendan was one of the few to get out immediately. Combat, you know, it's complicated. It's a long conversation, but there is something very profound and meaningful about being in a small group in a mortally dangerous situation where everyone is required to do their part. As Brendan said to me once, you know, there are guys in the platoon who straight up hate each other, but we'd all die for each other. Being part of a group where the individuals feel that way about each other is incredibly reassuring. And these guys come back to society and they don't have the security of a group like that. It's impossible to recreate in civilian society, and they miss it. It's worth the connection that happens in combat is worth the risk that you undergo when you're there.
Speaking of returning to civilian society, here is an excerpt from Restrepo, after which Sebastian will tell us who Restrepo was. Here's a piece from his award-winning documentary, Restrepo. Do we have that back there? Number two. I'm sorry, the one that talks about returning to the civilian world. My apologies.
Are you going to go back to the civilian world?
I have no idea.
I still obviously haven't figured out how to deal with it inside. The only hope I have right now is that eventually I'll be able to process it differently. I'm never going to forget it. I don't want to not have that as a memory, because that was one of the moments that makes me appreciate everything that I have.
You know, we hear these reports, and actually there's been some wonderful reporting in this station about the number of suicides when men and women come home as compared to the combat deaths over there. How prepared are these people for the civilian world when they have to return?
Let me just say that was from the trailer that National Geographic made from our movie. That we didn't have a musical score, but how prepared are they for coming home?
And how helped are? How much help do they get returning and making the transition when they get home?
I mean, in my experience, they get a fair amount of help. The offers of help, but it's bureaucratic help. So sometimes it's hard to schedule an appointment with a therapist or get your medication or get your VA check or whatever. So I think the machine is there. And there's an enormous amount of help offered. But the machine is a bureaucratic one and it's quite frustrating. And the guys who have the worst PTSD obviously navigate the bureaucracy the least well. And so they are the guys who really need it. It's a complicated situation.
Who was Restrepo, Sebastian Younger, after whom your documentary was named?
Restrepo was the platoon medic. his name was Juan Sebastian Restrepo, and he was born in the country of Colombia and emigrated to this country as a child and died fighting for this country at the foot of a hill in Afghanistan. The outpost that they built at the top of that hill, they named after him, O.P. Restrepo.
You know, we want to hear from people who have fought in either of these wars. If you're a father, mother, sister, brother, spouse of someone who served in Iraq or Afghanistan, give us a buzz. It's 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You didn't have a political point of view. You just wanted, it appears, Sebastian Younger, you just wanted to tell the story about combat, which most of us who sit back home as armchair generals or disinterested citizens know nothing about. That was your agenda, was it not, just to bring the what war is like home to people who don't suffer those sort of things?
Yeah, I mean, I have plenty of political points of view, but I feel that as a journalist, it's not appropriate to sort of overtly try to lead people to your personal conclusions. That's advocacy, and it's fine, but it's not journalism. My goal with Restrepo and with my book War was to show what it feels like to be in combat as an American soldier in Afghanistan. There's other journalists doing great work covering the strategic and the political aspects of the war. Should we not be there? All great work. But I just didn't want to do that with this. You can't sort of do both. And I really wanted to focus on the soldiers for this work.
We're talking with Sebastian Younger, who's going to be in Boston Friday commemorating the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. The reason I asked you before, Sebastian, about Sergeant Brendan O'Byrne was you had written that he was concerned about having sinned in the war, you know, that he didn't really have to join the Army and so forth. And you gave a great, I've never heard this before, proposal about one of the ways it would help not only the soldiers deal with their feelings of sin or doing bad things, would help the rest of us confront what we've done in our own wars in the United States of America. Tell us about your idea for a monument, unlike, you know, the Hiroshima monument, or unlike, you know, the big statues. Tell us about your monument.
Well, there's a great moral burden that comes with killing, and I, you know, I say that as a journalist who believes that some wars need to be fought, or it's better if they're fought. So I'm not in any way sort of a pacifist in that sense. But I know there's a great moral burden that comes with killing, that even comes with witnessing killing, as I have as a journalist. And it really troubles some of the soldiers, and they all feel they did their job and they did it as honorably and well as they could, but they still understand they have blood on their hands, and it's blood that our whole nation actually has on our hands. The soldiers are over there fighting for us. Whether you believe in the war or not, they are over there doing it, and we are all paying for it. And the civilians who died in Afghanistan and Iraq, if you agree with the political statement that that the soldiers are defending freedom for us, if you agree with that, and I have some concerns about that sentence, but if you do agree with that, then the civilians who died in these conflicts also died for freedom, and that they should be acknowledged. And I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing to have a monument to the civilians who died in the last 10 or 12 years in the war on terror, with, you know, a monument that offers no comment about the right or wrong of the war. It just acknowledges that this happened, that it's very sad, and it might give the soldiers some place to go to sort of, I don't know, try to resolve some of their grief about the things that happened.
Well, if we had votes, we'd vote for that. Oh, we're talking to Sebastian Younger, who has written the book War and made the film Restrepo with Tim Hetherington. On the phone is Ben from Providence, Rhode Island. He's an Iraq war vet. Welcome, Ben, to Boston Public Radio. You're talking to Sebastian Younger.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I really just wanted to touch out to Sebastian. I saw combat in Iraq, and his mention of the camaraderie and everything, I think, is really spot on. And it's really not about what's, you know, the political aspects or anything like that. It's really about the guys to the left and the right of you and making sure that you all do your job well and that you all go home. And I just wanted to thank Sebastian for what he does. I'm also a documentary filmmaker, and I really want to, you know, get back at it. And, you know, being a war reporter was definitely something I've thought of. And just wanted to thank Sebastian for what you did. You made an amazing film, and it really touched a lot of people. So I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Ben, thanks for your call. Sebastian?
Oh, well, thank you very much for that. I that really makes me feel good. I appreciate you calling. I feel really, you know, frankly, I feel very lucky and very honored that I was able to do this work over in Afghanistan with the soldiers, and really for my past 20 years covering wars. I'm not doing it anymore. After Tim got killed, I just decided not to cover wars anymore. But I spent 20 years doing it, and I feel incredibly fortunate, actually.
That's the voice of Sebastian Younger. If you fought in either of those wars, Iraq or Afghanistan, like Ben did from Providence, you can give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. You mentioned a minute ago that, you know, the blood on our hands is on the hands of all Americans. But it seems to me that throughout this process, other than when there's an appropriation or the president makes a major announcement, most Americans have absolutely no skin in the game. One, obviously, it's a volunteer military, so the vast majority of us don't go to sleep worried about someone we love not waking up the next morning. And secondly, we haven't even had to pay for this. Taxes were cut in the middle of the Iraq war, not raised to pay for a war. So isn't there this huge disconnect between the reality of war and the people back home in whose name these men and women are fighting?
There is a huge disconnect, and I just, you know, I wasn't alive during World War II, obviously, but I have the feeling that the scale of U.S. involvement in World War II really precluded anyone being kind of oblivious about it, or not being concerned, not being involved. We have a very small military in terms of manpower. We actually, apparently, a general told me this. He told me that our economy isn't big enough to really sustain a bigger military in terms of manpower. It's a huge drain on resources. to care for veterans throughout their lives as we do, and that limits the number of people in uniform, boots on the ground. But that also means that the country isn't that involved in the wars that we're in. But I should add that there are a lot of things that get people killed. A lot of industries, construction, farming, drilling for oil, logging, commercial fishing, people get killed all the time doing jobs that this nation needs done. And I don't think this nation is particularly plugged into any of it. You know, just as a general point about the obliviousness of our society, I think we're missing quite a bit of it.
We have Hank from Clinton on the phone. Hank, thanks for calling. You're on the phone with Sebastian Younger. Go ahead.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Roger. Hey, Sebastian. Thanks for putting me on.
Thanks,
on your last point, you know, I was in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and in a lot of the chow halls, there was a big sign on the wall that would say, the U.S. Army's at war and the USA's at the mall. and that's the way we felt a lot, you know, quite honestly. And I'm sure Sebastian picked that up. But with the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq coming up, what are your thoughts on how much longer that caused the Afghan war to last with the diversion of resources into Iraq? And again, people not really paying a heck of a lot of attention to it.
How about it, Sebastian?
Oh, Hank, God, don't get me started.
No, get me started.
Go ahead. Rant and rave.
So I started going to Afghanistan in the mid-90s. I was there in 2000 with Massoud. I was there in 2001 when his forces, after his assassination, his forces took Kabul back from the Taliban with our help, obviously. The Afghans were immensely grateful. And I'm politically very liberal. I have a lot of liberal friends. And they were all really surprised when I came home and said, you know, I was walking around Kabul and Afghans were coming up to me and hugging me on the street and thanking me for what the United States did. That, to many liberals, was really surprising. But the Bush administration did not capitalize on that, on the crushing, their crushing defeat of the Taliban on the, and on the huge goodwill that we had in Afghanistan. And they just moved on to Iraq, and they left something like 15,000 American soldiers in Afghanistan. I mean, there's 40,000 cops in New York City. It was a preposterous idea. It wasn't going to work. And I think had the Bush administration – I was totally against the Iraq war, and I felt that in Afghanistan we actually had the chance to do quite a bit of good, and the 9/11 justification was, in my mind, absolutely reasonable. But had we focused the kind of energy that we put into Baghdad – had we focused that into Afghanistan, I don't think the Taliban would have had a chance. I don't think there'd even be a war there right now. I think we would have completely remade that part of the world in a very, very positive way, and we blew it. We blew that chance, and it's a real tragedy.
Hank, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, Sebastian, as long as we're talking about politics, what should we be doing now in Afghanistan, in your estimation, having been there?
Well, I, as a journalist, I hesitate to sort of give recommendations. A friend of mine said a wonderful thing. Journalists shouldn't tell you what to think. They should tell you what to think about. And in keeping with that, I guess what I would say we should think about is, you know, on the one hand, we could not have killed bin Laden and decimated al-Qaeda from flying SEAL Team 6 from Northern Virginia. We couldn't have done it. We had to be in Afghanistan and we have decimated al-Qaeda. We had to be in Afghanistan to do that. When we pull out, there is a very high chance of a huge escalation in the war on the ground. And by the war, I mean a continuation of the civil war that was going on in the 1990s. I mean, because NATO forces are there, Afghanistan is experiencing the lowest level of civilian casualties in 30 years. And when we pull out, there's a real chance it'll escalate catastrophically. And so, I think what we probably need is some balance where there's enough security forces to keep the country from getting overrun by the Taliban, but not so many, not such a presence that we're sort of politically, geostrategically compromised. It's going to be very, very tricky, I think.
When people were in that valley, were along with you, Sebastian, the division about the war in Afghanistan, it was a lot closer. There was a majority support. We're now in a situation where close to 2/3 of Americans think we should be out right away. Obviously, the president has responded in some way to that. Did these guys talk about whether or not they had support back home, or did that not even matter to them? All they were worried about was survival and getting through the next day.
You know, they were all out there because they joined the army. Like, they all wanted to be soldiers, and they all had to work quite hard to get into an airborne infantry unit where they'd be likely to see combat. And when they went over there in the spring of 07, one of their big concerns was that they'd be in a part of Afghanistan where there wasn't any combat, and they'd be sitting around all day drinking tea with village elders. And so they're very much approaching it as sort of young men who wanted this experience, and some of them regretted the choice, but they never really questioned the country's decisions to go to war in Afghanistan. They never really talked about it because it's not a draft army. The main decision that put them on that hilltop was their own decision to join.
No, but I meant, people like me who said things like, I'm against the war, I do support the troops, but and millions like me didn't do it in any tangible way. Did they resent those of us who said we didn't support the war effort?
They didn't really care.
They didn't care.
Actually, I don't think they cared that much. I mean, they wanted to do their deployment, do their mission, do their job, and get out of there alive. And they came home to a lot of respect from people. And they also understood. I mean, some of them understood that the Iraq War really muddied the conversation about what we were doing. Afghanistan was pretty clear. Right? I mean, 9/11, we go into Afghanistan chasing al-Qaeda after the Taliban refused to hand them over. I mean, it all kind of made sense to people and to the soldiers. Iraq was a lot more complicated, and they do understand that that changed a lot of people's opinions who otherwise would have been more more supportive of the war in Afghanistan as well.
You know, Sebastian, this is just a question for you as a journalist. You know, you've covered really dramatic stuff. Everybody around here knows you wrote The Perfect Storm, the tragedy out of the Gloucester with the fishermen that were killed in that huge hurricane. So how do you move from war reporting to which is the most dramatic thing possible? What do you cover after this? I mean, you can't go do the PTA or anything, I don't think, Sebastian.
It's interesting. War reporting is incredibly easy in a lot of ways. It's easy to write about war because it's so dramatic. It's so incredibly dramatic. And it's actually a lot harder to write about the rest of life. And as you get older, as I've gotten older and have been doing this kind of work for a while, for 20 years almost, you start out thinking in the sort of excitement of combat, you start out thinking that real life actually only happens in combat. And then as you get older, you realize that, like, real life is happening everywhere. And I think I want to keep developing as a writer. And in some ways, I mean, war reporting got too dangerous. I didn't want to get killed, but it also got too easy. Like, I'd figured out how to do it. And I've moved on to the, in some ways, much greater challenges of writing in a really compelling way about the rest of life. I mean, that for me really kind of is the Mount Everest, and I hope I can climb that hill.
Yeah, before you go, Sebastian Younger, you touched on this earlier, something Marjorie said. What's your relationship with, like, and how constant is it with the men with whom you spent months and months in this valley in eastern Afghanistan? What's your relationship like now?
Well, I got closer to some guys than to others. Some I've completely lost touch with. Some I hear from every few months. And some I talk to almost every day, like Brendan. Brendan O'Byrne and I are very, very good friends. And so I'm in pretty continual contact with him.
Sebastian Younger, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Great book, great film, The Book's War, and the movie, the documentary, obviously, Restrepo. Thanks for your time, Sebastian.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Very much for being with us. And Sebastian Younger will be at WGBH this Friday, among other journalists, for a conversation about the war in Iraq. To learn more about that and to buy tickets for what should be a great evening, go to wgbh.org/events. Okay, when we come back, more Pope Talk with a look at how Cardinal O'Malley's rise to international recognition could change things back here in Boston. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Author Catherine Patterson has a long list of young adult classics to her credit, but she began her career before her own children were old enough to read them.
A lot is going on in your head when you're changing diapers and doing all those things that have to be done.
Award-winning author Catherine Patterson shares her wisdom about writing next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Dedham Savings, providing personal and business banking services to the community. Proud to support WGBH and the Boston Speaker Series, Wednesday, March 20th with Vicente Fox at Boston Symphony Hall. And the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Austin community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu.
This is Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marg Regan. As she said, more Pope talk. Even if he isn't elected Pope, Sean O'Malley will return to Boston, viewed by many as an almost Pope. With us to discuss what that might mean is Michelle Dillon. She's department chair and professor of sociology at the University of New Hampshire. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michelle. So what do you think? If Cardinal O'Malley wins or is elected, all bets are off, I guess. But if he comes in not a winner, how does it change things for the Boston Archdiocese or for the surrounding areas?
Well, I think it will have some impact. I think it will be a limited impact, but there's a big difference, obviously, between becoming Pope and then being an also-ran or an almost Pope.
Just ask Mitt Romney, by the way. He would know the answer to that.
Right.
Well, I think this is a little different, though.
So?
I think, though, the fact that so many people have now seen Cardinal O'Malley on the international stage, and I think a lot of people have been watching television over the last few days, and I think many, including many in the Boston Archdiocese, many Catholics, are probably seeing Cardinal O'Malley in a very different light than they might have already known him as. I think most Catholics really don't have much interaction with the Cardinal in terms of ordinary, everyday parish life. They see him sometimes if they go to the cathedral. And so, oftentimes when they do see him, he's in his brown Capuchin robes, which, quite frankly, are not the most flattering, whereas when you see him in the red garb and all the pageantry of the last few days, he certainly looks very well. And so that sort of seems superficial, but I think in terms of the visual image of that, his stature increases. And I think the fact then when he comes back to Boston, he still has to face all the problems in the archdiocese, but I think people might, give him more of the benefit of the doubt, if you will. And certainly among his fellow bishops here, in the U.S. more generally, I think he's going to have greater political clout.
Well, why do you? But I'm surprised though after that sentence that you said at the beginning of that sentence, Michelle Dillon, that you, I don't remember what your adjective was, but that the impact would be modest. I mean, he has become a much larger figure on an international stage. We've all been reading excerpts from Italian newspapers, and the National Catholic Reporter, John Allen, the National Catholic Reporter yesterday wrote that he's essentially a rock star. All of Rome has a love affair with Cardinal Sean. So why wouldn't he, at least on the American stage, not to mention the Boston stage, why would he not come back a much larger figure than he left?
Well, let me just take this rock star metaphor. We've heard a lot of it over the last several weeks. In fact, people have been in the media, including mainstream media, comparing, for example, Ratzinger, that he was so diminished compared to the rock star that John Paul II was. And it's absolutely true that John Paul was highly charismatic. But what has been forgotten in all of this sort of gushing over these rock star figures in the church is that at the end of the day, American Catholics do their own thing. So a lot of people turned out in large crowds to greet John Paul II, as they did Benedict, but they went home and continued doing more or less the kinds of things they always do, even if it contravenes, and in many instances does contravene, official church teaching on contraceptions, divorce, same sex, all of these issues. And so I think it's the same certainly with Cardinal O'Malley, or even if he becomes Pope, for example. I don't think the Boston Catholics or the U.S. Catholics are going to suddenly change their behavior just because there's a Pope who's an American, even though certainly American Catholics take a lot of pride in the papacy and like the symbolism of it and the pageantry, but nonetheless, in terms of real impact, in terms of their lives, I don't think it's going to be a significant impact.
If you want to weigh in on what the impact of this high-profile week in Rome, even if he doesn't come in number one, has on the future of Sean O'Malley back home, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. Again, that's 877-301-8970. We're speaking to Michelle Dillon from UNH.
Well, you know, Michelle, I do have one theory about what the impact could be on local Catholics, and many, and I am a local Catholic, and I've ignored the hierarchy for years. But, you know, he's hitting you up big time on the Catholic Appeal, you know, and he's needing money, and he's putting the pressure on the local parishes to give more of the local donations from the parishes to him. So he could take a little nice, tidy uptick in the Catholic Appeal. What do you think?
Yes, I do think that's one possibility. But of course, we've already been seeing an uptick in the Catholic Appeal over the last several years. It really dipped back in 01, 02, 03, and then started climbing and has been climbing very consistently. So yes, maybe people will give a few more dollars than they're giving and they'll say, oh, he seems like such a good guy and attractive and all of this. But I really don't see it in terms of getting on with the everyday business of the Archdiocese.
Yep.
And now in particular, the Archdiocese, the current, if you like, task of reorganizing parishes, for example, people in the local parishes are, you know, still going to be skeptical of some of the new plans that the Archdiocese has in place. So, yes, it certainly enhances his stature. And, you know, people always like when their own neighbor becomes famous, in this case, their own bishop. But, you know, I think ultimately, in terms of the everyday life of the Archdiocese, the impact won't be as long-lasting as it might be in terms of the U.S. Bishops' Conference itself, where I think, I mean, he already has leadership roles. He's been head of the pro-life committee.
Right.
But I think in terms of national visibility, Cardinal Dolan has won that rock star status, and he might be losing some of that edge because of the way Cardinal O'Malley has come to the fore in Rome.
Well,
so that's, I think, something interesting.
We're talking with Michelle Dillon from UNH, who is an expert of this sort of thing. I wonder what you think in terms of the Catholic Church in general. I mean, it's not probable, but it's possible that we could have O'Malley as the next pope, less likely as Dolan. But what do you think? How do you view these two men? And what do you think of O'Malley? What do you think of Dolan? And what do you think the impact would be if one of them were to ascend to the papacy?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's not impossible that either of them could become pope. I mean, I really felt this all along, even when the people were asking who were going to be the top 10 candidates. It really is, it seems to me, a very open field. And the more the cardinals deliberate and make, you know, elect or write down who it is that they want to vote for, and then they see the various factions, because I think there's more than two factions in the church. There are several factions, I would suggest, among these cardinals. And so I think it's an interesting process. Unfortunately, we can't see it in action, but who can emerge could be someone very much like Sean O'Malley, or indeed Cardinal Dolan, even though I do think perhaps his exuberant personality might be too much of a threat. But I think, you know, I'm not sure. A lot of people have talked about Cardinal O'Malley, that he's such an image of humility.
Right.
And certainly he does seem, I mean, he is, after all, a Franciscan monk, and he certainly has this very humble demeanor. When he first came to Boston, you know, he made a very important, very significant gesture by selling off the Bishop's Palace, for example, and living in a much more frugal, modest lifestyle. But what you can do at the local level or at the archdiocese level, even though Boston is a very significant archdiocese, you cannot do at the global Catholic level, the global church level. So if he were to become pope, he can't begin by, you know, selling off some of the Vatican property or, you know, I think those sorts of things really would be impossible for him to do. What instead he has to do is to really take seriously the governance within the curia. And I'm not sure that humility is necessarily a good thing in that context. You know, you need someone who's decisive and who's not going to be intimidated by their plan and their vision as to how the church should look. And I don't know whether Cardinal O'Malley is too humble to be an executive leader, for example.
Well, you know, now beyond the issue of executive leader, I think the average person in Boston who doesn't have a close personal relationship with Sean O'Malley would say he has been very low profile and is camera shy, is press shy, and those sort of things. How does one go from that? And you're amongst those who say it's very possible he could end up being the next pope.
Yes.
Well, possible. My apologies.
Nothing is impossible.
Being the next pope. How does one go from that to being arguably one of the, if not the most high-profile person on the planet. I just don't see how you make that transition, particularly in a week.
Yes, and I totally agree with you. And in fact, I think it is, there's a probability, but I actually don't necessarily think it would necessarily be the best choice. I mean, I think in terms of how consensus candidates emerge, I would be concerned that he's too humble, mm-hmm. whereas I would imagine that someone like Cardinal Dolan, even though he certainly loves the limelight and maybe gets too distracted by it, I think he seems to, and I don't know either of these personally, but he seems to have more of that leadership possibility, because even when Sean O'Malley does his annual appeal that you've referred to, he speaks on video or on audio through such and has such a deep voice, it's actually hard to hear him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's almost like he's mumbling. and of course, and, you know, so yes, he's humble and he's, you know, seems like a kind person, but people in the pews need to hear exactly what he's saying about why the church needs money, let's say, in Boston, never mind then if he's going to be giving his global blessing, you know, from St. Peter's, as well as going around the world and being engaged with the varieties of Catholics that exist.
Well, do you have a favorite, Michelle Dillon? I mean, Scola and the Cher from Brazil, Scola being from Milan and Cher from Brazil are the supposed two front runners. Do you think there's one of these men that would be, and of course it is just men, as we know, right. but would be better or make a difference? I mean, the Catholic Church has a big problem with this sex abuse crisis, not just in the United States, obviously, but practically all over the world now.
Well, I personally don't have a favorite. I really don't have a favorite. And in part why I don't have a favorite is because, going back to the other earlier question, you know, whoever becomes Pope is themselves has been and has gone through the hierarchy of the Church
right.
to become the figure that they are today. All of those cardinals in there right now at the conclave, they have all, you know, they're all company men. They've all been yes men, frankly. They've achieved their position in part. Yes, they're holy men at some level, but it's also because they're able to play the politics within the Church. Now, once they become Pope, I have great trust that whoever becomes Pope and takes on this totally new role, even someone like Cardinal O'Malley, that they realize that they're no longer just in charge of this little or this particular diocese or this division within the Vatican, but they do have an obligation to take seriously the common good of the whole Church. And I think that hopefully that transformation, even though it doesn't happen magically or overnight, allows them to bring new, you know, to be more open-minded perhaps than they have been in the past, to make an effort to be more pastoral. I mean, Benedict, I think to give him credit, he certainly wasn't a charismatic figure, as we've said, and he seemed much more happy, you know, much happier reading and being a theologian. But to give him his due, he came across very well and made an effort to be pastoral. I mean, he did a lot of global visits. So I think, you know, the Pope, the obligations of being Pope are tremendous. And I think whoever becomes Pope knows the problems in the Church, and they know that they really have to put their best foot forward to deal with those problems.
But, you know, we have to go back half a century, really, to John the 23rd in 1958. Mm-hmm. But he shocked everybody, correct? I mean, he was supposed to be this pushover, this caretaker
yes.
pope. He was quite old, I think in his late 70s when he was elected, and he revolutionized the whole Church. They've been trying to undermine his revolutions almost nonstop since, but he stunned everybody. I mean, he was like the stealth Pope.
Yes, absolutely. And so when people are saying, oh, should it be a younger man? I know today the obligations of traveling and the expectation that you travel the globe are certainly, you know, you need physical and mental energy. But to me, there's no such thing as a caretaker pope, because you can just be pope for a year and still convene, as you say, about John the 23rd, he was a pope for less than 5 years, convene some major synod or council of the Church that can really redirect it to become relevant yet again in the 21st century. And I think that that's in a sense the open possibility, or that's what gives a lot of Catholics hope in this time, that yes, they are very aware of all the problems confronting the Church, but they also have a certain faith that whoever does become Pope could be that person who is able to re-energize it and revitalize it.
Now, Michelle Dillon, my last question, even though you were dismissive of my reference to Mitt Romney, I'm going to go back at it one more time, Michelle. I'm undaunted. I'm not a historian, nor clearly not a church historian. When you're, let's say, one of the five finalists through history, or 10 finalists,
yes.
you're one of the people, and you come back almost being the most powerful person in the Church that you've given your life to, but you didn't quite make it. Has anything been written about how these men deal with coming in second?
Oh,
no, I'm serious.
No, that's a very good question. I quite frankly, do not know whether anyone has studied that. That actually sounds like a good project. But it seems to me like in a lot of competitions in life, being runner-up is just not good enough. People forget who the runner-up is quickly enough. I mean, he will, you know, his stature, I really do believe, has increased, both within the archdiocese, mm-hmm. just in terms of how he looks in his red robes, I think makes a lot of Boston Catholics take a second look.
That's
and
right.
certainly, I think he's gained visibility as a national figure and certainly among his fellow bishops here as a possible the president of the Catholic Conference or whatever. But after a while, people forget. You don't go around waving a flag saying, oh, I got second or I got third.
No, what you do is you end up having your photograph taken at Costco, like Mitt Romney did, buying a pack of 48 rolls of toilet paper.
Right. Well, that's, you know, people have their own way of finding meaning
right,
in
exactly.
life. And I think if you were to do these interviews that you're suggesting, which I think is a great idea with the cardinals, if they would sit down and answer these questions, I think most of them would have to say that, of course, they were humbled and honored
sure.
that they were even mentioned, but that they know that the Holy Spirit works in mysterious ways and that they really believe that this person whom they ended up electing is, you know, the person to lead the church forward.
Yeah, so, but then Michelle Dillon, someone like you would say, however, Cardinal, my question is, how are you feeling after being one of the also-rans? And maybe some of them, maybe like someone like Dolan might be candid about what it was like to almost have
well,
this.
Well, he's looking for his whiskey over there.
That's
at the
what he
conclave.
Said, right?
He'll be looking for more whiskey, I guess, if he gets back to New York, Michelle, without
well,
the...
Well, I don't know, but I know that Cardinal Ratzinger said that when you become pope, you have absolutely no privacy, and that's probably true. And I think most of these cardinals have a pretty nice lifestyle as it is. Yes, I think it'd be if I were a man and a cardinal, I'd love to be pope for sure.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think, and of course they all could be. I mean, any of them could be whenever we know in a few days. But I don't think it's something you would dwell on after the fact in the way that Mitt Romney obviously would be dwelling on his loss of the presidential election.
Okay, no more Mitt Romney
Cardinal
references.
I don't think Cardinal O'Malley is going to wake up and say, oh, if only whatever, right?
If only the press hadn't been so unkind to me, maybe I'd be the Pope.
Michelle Dillon,
thanks so much. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
Michelle Dillon is a professor of sociology and department chair at the University of New Hampshire. I hadn't thought of it until Michelle mentioned it, but she's right. Sean O'Malley does look very snappy, Jim, I think, in those red outfits. Okay, up next, it's Open Mic with Brian McGrory, the editor of the Boston Globe. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Collaboration, innovation, and engineering serendipity in Silicon Valley.
People walk down between the chairs, they bump into each other. It's actually called a Google bump. And you go, hey, and then you sit down and talk.
Designing workplaces meant to keep employees happy, creative, and in the office. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Bunker Hill Community College, providing more than 105 degrees and certificates. For more information, you can visit bhcc.mass.edu. Bunker Hill Community College. Imagine the possibilities. And PBS NewsHour. Stay informed on the issues that matter to you with television's most trusted news source. Watch PBS NewsHour with Jeffrey Brown and Gwen Ifill, weeknights at 6 on WGBH2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday at or about 1 o'clock on Open Mic. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. He's the author of Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. And he is here today to explain to us why neither Marjorie nor I made it onto the 25 most stylish Bostonians in the Boston Globe. Did you make those selections, Brian McGrory?
If only it was a 27 most stylish.
That's right.
Trust me when I say you would have been on.
Well, that's actually very kind. I assumed that was the
case.
Right
on the edge.
We had to cut it off somewhere. It was very arbitrary. I don't know why they wouldn't do 27.
Especially since Jim and I talk about people that look beautifully dressed every single day. So, Brian, I mean, it's probably... Well, it could happen. I mean, suppose Sean O'Malley becomes the next pope. What do you do at the Boston Globe? Do you have the Pope pull out edition or the Pope of Palooza or the souvenir? I mean, you're going to make a big deal out of this, right?
Well, I mean, this would be, and Marjorie, I mean, you know this from the Herald, this would probably be the biggest story we have had here in Boston since Kennedy was elected president, you know, going back to 1960.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable. I mean, so yeah, in answer to your question, we would pull out all the stops. We have... This is a long shot. I mean, it is. We all understand this is a long shot. You guys understand that, right?
Yes, we do.
It's a long shot. This guy from Milan seems to be the guy who probably has the inside track. But we already have mock-ups of a front page ready to go. We have David Filipov, our great former foreign correspondent and terrific all-purpose reporter, jetting right now to Rome. He's probably on the ground, actually, already to join Lisa Wangsness over there, who I think has done fabulous
work. She has, actually.
From the conclave and prior to the conclave meeting. And we're ready to roll here. I mean, it would be no holds barred if O'Malley is elected.
And by the way, for people who don't understand about preparation, it's sort of like when someone famous is going to die in the next year or two. Obviously, newspapers like yours and the Herald are preparing obituaries in advance. A lot of your stuff is going to be in the can, so to speak, ready to go with like 42 stories on this guy. Are they not?
It's a good question. Yes and no. I mean, yes, we do have stuff in the can ready to go, but no in that I don't want to devote the entire staff to writing stories right now that we're not going to run. I mean, we are doing a lot of research. We have prepared a story that's ready to go if he is named. But it's not like we have 10 or 15 stories. We're counting on, you know, putting a lot of stuff together in a very short amount of time from the knowledge we already have of this of this cardinal. And the knowledge we have, just like the knowledge that Marjorie has and you guys have over there, is pretty strong and goes back to when he arrived here.
Yeah, I surely don't want to tell you your business, Brian McGrory, now that you're editor, but had I been editor last week, he and his capuchin outfit would have been one of my 25 most stylish Bostonians. But it's water under the bridge.
If it was 28, the top 28, you would have been in front of him, Jim. Trust me.
You know, Brian, one of our colleagues had a great idea yesterday. If Sean O'Malley does win, suggesting that we need to have a duck boat parade down Commonwealth Avenue.
Here's the funny part, because I've been asking this question. So if he wins,
yes,
if he wins, does he return to Boston to then go back to Rome? I'm actually told that he probably would not.
That's what we understand as well. As you stay there, you become Pope. You're head of the 1.whatever number yeah. billion Roman Catholics.
You just stay there. There's no, he hardly has any belongings back here. He has taken a vow of poverty. There's not, there's not a whole lot to pick up back home.
A couple of pairs of sandals.
Yeah, and he just stays there.
Okay, let's come to something that is more definite as opposed to speculative. You started a crusade, for lack of a better expression, as a columnist about Tom May. I think you referred to him as the $9 million man or some such thing, obviously head of a public utility, NSTAR at the time, that ultimately was folded into Northeast Utilities. The crusade is being picked up by the Attorney General, who is a little upset, apparently, because, and actually she's on the front lead story in the Globe yet again today, because Northeast Utilities will not disclose the last few months of compensation of Tom May, which may include, and this comes from your column and your research as well a year or so ago, may include as much as $10 million or more in stock options. What's your take on current events with Tom May, Brian McGrory?
Well, first of all, once again, you twisted my words.
How so?
On what I called Tommy. You said I called him the $9 million man.
What'd you do?
I called him the $9.1 million utility man.
I'm sorry for that.
Thank you. Thank you. I am very surprised about this, that as I think a lot of people are, that they're not just divulging his compensation package. The spirit of the SEC rules require that. I am surprised that the shareholders of Northeast Utilities aren't expecting this, and maybe they are. And I think it's very interesting that Martha Coakley is doing what the governor doesn't seem to be doing, and that is pressing the case for public disclosure of what he made. The reality is they did disclose what he made for 9 months with Northeast Utilities after NSTAR and Northeast Utilities merged. What they're not disclosing is what he made those first 3 months of the year when he was CEO of NSTAR, and any vesting, any bonuses he received during and because of the merger, because they're saying through a technicality that NSTAR no longer exists as a company, so they don't have to say what he made.
Yeah, when you say, you mentioned that Deval Patrick hasn't spoken about this, I think the story was in your paper. When this originally broke and the Attorney General was on the case last week, and by the way, the governor's with us tomorrow noon, we will ask him about this. The governor didn't comment. The co-chairs of all relevant committees on Beacon Hill didn't comment. What's the deal? You know, it's sort of, you know, when the NRA owns Congress, you say, well, I get that. What does Tom May and NSTAR Northeast Utilities have on the men and women in Beacon Hill that they're mute about something? And I think most ratepayers care a lot.
I think they donate a lot of money to their campaigns. That would be my supposition.
They do, Marjorie, although we've looked at that, and not quite as much as you would think. I honestly don't know, and it's a really good question that I hope you ask the governor tomorrow. I happen to think, and I think you guys agree, that pay inequity in this country is a really big issue right now. It's been an issue for a while.
It's not just pay inequity. It's, as you said in your endless series of columns a year or so ago about Tom May, this is a public utility. The ratepayer has no option. It isn't like he or she can go somewhere else. And what did you mention in your piece, that he was the fourth highest paid utility guy in the country, or some obscene kind of
also,
thing.
Also, Massachusetts has very high electricity rates compared to the rest of the country as well.
Yeah, we do have high electricity rates. And Jim, you're right that people do not have a choice where they get their energy here. You know, you're either in the Northeast Utilities / NSTAR territory, you're in the National Grid territory, unless you're in one of these communities that has their own power plant or their own power option.
Yeah, municipal light companies.
Right,
yeah.
Which is another thing.
I think Hingham might have one, which those communities seem to have fewer outages and shorter outages
they
do have them.
And but lower rates, by the way.
I really believe that CEO pay is a major issue right now. I mean, you kind of sloughed that off a few minutes ago, but it's a huge issue right now. In terms of the average worker has seen their pay flat or decrease, since the recession, through the recession. Well, CEO pay is booming again, and there's something really profoundly wrong with that.
Oh, it's one of the big things that leads to the problems with the economy, at least in some of the problems with the economy, because there's this huge rich getting richer, poor getting poorer, the middle class getting squeezed. But I'm glad Elizabeth Warren is down there making that point. But I want to ask you something about this. I was chagrined, I must admit, because I've been trying to get an interview with Debbie DeMacy for quite some time. Unfortunately, you guys got it over there at the Globe. I didn't. But it was a great piece on Debbie DeMacy, wife
Thank
of Sal
you.
DeMacy. She's talking about his health problems and how, at least in Debbie DeMacy's estimation, and it was pretty convincing to me, that the Bureau of Prisons has not taken care of the health problems, or not soon enough for Sal DeMacy. What I was stunned about, Brian, is nobody's answering. This Bureau of Prisons, I mean, we know about Sal DeMacy because he's a famous guy, former Speaker of the House, and Debbie DeMacy talked about them. But if Sal DeMacy's not getting his cancer treated as soon as he should, what about the other thousands of people that are in federal custody in jail? It was a really scary story.
It's a pretty alarming story. For those who didn't read it, Sal DeMacy, former Speaker of the House, went to prison. 8-year jail term shortly after he got there. He was diagnosed with tongue cancer. And the view is from the DeMacy family that he wasn't treated quickly enough or aggressively enough from that cancer, and that that caused it to get worse, and he's in a pretty bad place. What did the story say? He lost 40 pounds or something like that. He's on a feeding tube now. They did a PET scan recently that showed some alarming signs that the cancer might have returned. And Debbie DeMacy rightly raises the point with reporter Milton Valencia, who I think did a terrific job with the story, that how often is this happening in the prison system? What cases are we not hearing about where people go untreated? You know, Sal was not meant to get a death sentence here. He was meant to get an 8-year sentence, and you hope that one didn't turn into the other, because you know, that would be really hard to rectify.
You know, a lot of my liberal friends are in and out of the legislature, the ones who wrote letters both to the Globe after that story and then at the time of the sentencing at the Macy's saying he did so many great things, he doesn't deserve to go to jail. I parted with him. My view was his crime did deserve jail time.
He did deserve to go to jail.
Yeah, I don't know if he deserved 8 years. But the other issue that comes up in the Valencia piece, and Marjorie's written about this too in the past, is there's never been an explanation from the Federal Bureau of Prisons as to why this guy who is a nonviolent offender, put aside the health for a moment, why is he in Kentucky and North Carolina? He's not a member of a gang.
And the judge,
as opposed to a place where his wife and stepdaughter and other people can visit the
and
guy.
And the judge didn't want him to be in Kentucky
Wolf.
Either.
Judge Wolf had recommended that he be in a prison hospital facility up here in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Out at, where is that place? Out in,
Danvers or something? I don't know.
So what is that? But
I don't know where
he's
it is.
He's laughing at you, Marjorie.
It's in the suburbs somewhere.
Marjorie, that's a mall. That's,
okay. You get beyond 128. I'm out of my element. Brian, and so are you.
I think it's the Liberty Tree Mall.
Okay.
So maybe that's
whatever.
Where he was meant to go. Just walk around the Liberty Tree Mall every day for the rest of his life.
But nobody's gotten to the bottom of, because the Federal
it's
Bureau
enraging.
Of Prisons never answers the question. Why is the guy not, forget
they're
the
not,
hospital, why is he not near his family?
They're completely non-responsive on the issue. They haven't addressed the medical care he's gotten. And this goes back to another story we did, a series of stories we did last year on ICE and immigration and how these people are treated. Maria Sacchetti and Milton Valencia did that three-part series, which I hope you remember, on people kept in detention without families being told where they were, people not being released until the Globe asked questions about them. All because the federal immigration system is completely non-responsive to outside inquiry.
That is just enraging to me, and it makes you really scared about government unlimited power in this country. But anyway, I want to know something a little bit lighter here, Brian. I'm sure you're looking forward to Sunday morning, the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. I've seen you there, I think, on several occasions.
No,
have I not?
No.
What do you
mean no?
Wait a second. Excuse me. You never went to the St. Patrick's Day breakfast?
I went to one.
What was that? Weldon Bulger, I'm guessing.
Many years ago, a young reporter sent out there to cover it. No, this is not my thing. I once wrote a column saying Jack Hart, the former state senator over there, wonderful, wonderful guy.
He is a good guy.
Should never be allowed to hold a microphone in his hand again. And he called me up. He said, you know, I think you might be right, but I have to do it because it's part of my job.
Speaking of to do it, there is going to be a story on the front page of the Metro section of the Globe about the breakfast, is there not?
Yes, and it's going to be filled with some of the worst jokes ever told. One after another, these politicians get up to the podium and they recite jokes that some part-time joke writer or speech writer has written for them. They're usually repeating the person that went right before them. The laughs are all polite. It's awful. I mean, it's awful. And it fulfills every bad stereotype and cliche about the over-mothered Irish Pauls from Boston. I hate this breakfast.
Now, Brian,
I really do.
I don't want to tell you how
you know,
do.
I'm not even supposed to talk like this as the editor. You got me going. Jim, you know what, Jim? You're bad news here.
Thank you. No, that's been going on for a long time, Brian.
Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe. I don't want to tell you how to do your job, but you could make someone that we both know and love very, very happy if instead of the pictures of the politicians in the Metro front, Jim Browdy is the host of the St. Patrick's Day breakfast.
No, I'm the television
NBC.
Host. I am not the host.
He's the host. He's there for 3 hours on his podium. Maybe you could do him a favor and get a little shot of him up there.
What do you think, Brian?
So, Jim, are you over in the convention center or are you back in the studio?
No, this is, I am
there.
Embarrassed to say
he's
I am
alive.
On the scene. Now, a couple of years ago, I got to sit 15 feet from Ronan Tynan as he sang an interview. And by the way, have you ever heard Ronan Tynan sing up front, close? I'm serious.
He's good.
Unbelievable. He's unbelievable.
And this year, I will be about 15 feet from Celtic Woman. Have you ever heard them sing,
by the way? They're good.
I have not.
They are really good. Yeah. But sadly, good? I'll also only be about 100 feet from the stage, which will not be quite as one. You know what they should use, actually? I'm thinking now, if they could use that Liberty Tree Mall line and maybe say, instead, Sal DeMacy should have been at the Natick Collection. Maybe they can do that one, Brian.
Poor Sal DeMacy.
Listen.
It's your joke.
This is why Jim was so quiet when I was all over this breakfast, because he's now part of the institution.
Brian, make sure the Globe reporter comes by and says hello to me at the for breakfast, okay?
Listen, we would never go there without stopping by and saying hello to you.
Brian McGorry, it's a pleasure as always. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, guys.
That is Brian McGorry. He's with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow at Thursday, Christopher Lydon is going to join us. I think we're going to be talking about Rand Paul tomorrow.
Yes, we are, in drones.
But up next, we got a little March Madness deal going. We're going to talk about March Madness and then the game that's sweeping the country, the holy and unholy alike. Lent Madness. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You ever get this feeling as the first of the month rolls around?
Rent! It's too damn high!
You know, you might have a point. I'm Kai Rizdahl. What it means for you and your family when your rent is more than you make. That story and the rest of the day's business news, the numbers from Wall Street as well, next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Boston Lyric Opera, presenting Mozart's Così fan tutte at the City Performing Arts Center, Schubert Theater, March 15th through the 24th. You can learn more at BLO.org. That's BLO.org. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, offering complete health care for you and your family. With 21 locations across Greater Boston, Harvard Vanguard welcomes new patients and accepts most insurance. HarvardVanguard.org, an affiliate of Atrius Health.
That'll get you in the mood. This is Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us now in studio is a man who actually thinks he knows more about college basketball's March Madness than I do.
Is that dark smoke from the chimney?
But he is wrong.
Is that dark smoke or is that light smoke?
I think we may have made
a selection to the papal.
From the NECN sports file, that'd be Chris Collins. How are you, Chris? I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks.
Listen, I'll tell you what. Free water over here.
I don't know
what you did to get free water,
great.
But I'm
impressed. Know what we
it's
did?
In a bottle.
We got a case from Marco Rubio, actually. Sent it to us after his response to the statement.
No, impressed with
Thank
Rubio.
You.
Okay, yeah. So Chris Collins.
Well, first of all, I'm coming over here, mm-hmm. and I had a little difficulty because I just walked in, hence the reason my jacket is still on.
Your coat is mm-hmm. on.
I was flying down Stereo Drive.
Uh-huh.
Boo! Black guy. And a 78 Chevy Chevette will get pulled over every time. So my Chevette can barely get over, 30. So I must have been going like 33.
No. Boom! No.
But I told him I'm going to see Jim Browdy. You know what he told me?
What?
He's like, that guy's out of work. Where are you going to see him at? Marjorie Egan? Oh, yeah, Marjorie Egan. Yeah.
That's a different story.
Yeah,
that's
different
right.
Deal.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you very much. All those great stories I've done about police details.
Oh, they love you for that, Marjorie.
Must be that. So, Chris Collins.
Yes.
Some of us, like me, are not really up to speed on the March Madness phenomenon. So for the people like me who don't know about this, explain March Madness.
Well, you being of, Irish descent?
Irish descent.
Right, let me introduce you to the Winter Hill Gang. I mean, back in the day, I mean, they were running numbers, and that has evolved into March Madness. March Madness, if you do collectively, it's over 60-some-odd games. There's more money bet on March Madness than there is on the Super Bowl.
I read that this morning.
Which is
I was
hard to believe.
Stunned,
billions.
By the way.
Really?
Yeah, billions.
What? How come?
And just think about it. Because everybody even if you don't even pay any attention to sports, which I have a feeling somebody out there may on this on this station.
That's,
I don't know. I'm just assuming.
That's me.
But even if you don't pay any attention to sports, you're probably in an office pool.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So basically, the only people not gambling on this, if you don't have a gig of any sort, Jim Browdy would not be
working. No, that is it. By the way, that's exactly right. You know, on that note, by the way, it's interesting you say that. I was reading some statistics this morning while Chris Collins is here. If you want to give us a buzz at 877-301-8970, here's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for one of the 38% of workers in America who admit that they watch March Madness while they're at work on work time. Number two, we're looking for one of the people who engages in illegal betting, as Chris Collins just described.
Well,
and three, even if you don't do either, Productivity studies during March Madness suggest that the amount of work that comes out of the typical office drops precipitously. How long is March Madness? Like a month, 3 weeks?
Yeah,
like
about that? 3 weeks.
And if you want to give us a report, whether you're a boss or an employee, about how you suffer, if you do during March Madness, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. How many teams? It used to be 60. What is it now? 65? Yeah, 66?
Yeah,
whatever.
They added all these extra teams to get into the field of 64. But the big thing is, it's not really the whole tournament that's taken away from work productivity. It's really those first 2 weeks, because you have those Thursday and Friday games for two consecutive weeks. Those are the killers.
When
those
everybody plays, everybody plays.
Everybody's in and everybody's logging on because they're at work during the afternoon and they're playing these games starting at noon. That's what's going on.
I didn't know that gambling was illegal.
No.
All that time people have been sending around. Not in Massachusetts anymore.
Listen, but gambling has evolved. I mean, it's not just, you know, Vinny from East Boston anymore where you can get your numbers taken. No, it's everywhere. You know, it's anywhere.
It's in your office.
It's on the internet. It's in your office, which means it's in your office if it's on the internet. So, where you just used to be able to, you know, oh, okay, we got to block all the X sites and the porn sites. Now you got to block the gambling sites. They're everywhere.
You know, Chris Collins, on a serious note, you and I have talked about this 10, 15 years ago.
Jimmy, I love when you get serious.
I used to watch
first time I called him Jimmy.
I know, it's
show.
Jim, actually. I used to watch practically every game I could and follow. But since kids, and they are kids,
yes,
started leaving college for pro bowl as freshmen,
yes,
or sophomore, you got connected to this because the Magic Johnsons, the Larry Birds,
okay,
they all went to college for 4 years. So you
knew who they were. Well, first of all, you're incorrect because Magic Johnson came out early.
How many years did he go? I think he went three. Okay, whatever. 3 years, which is more. There's so many freshmen.
And Larry Bird was trying to come out early and then didn't get the right contract and went back for that extra year.
Because of his connection to the Celtics, ultimately, Red
Auerbach.
Yeah, but the point is, the average player stayed a lot longer than the average player does now. So it isn't anymore the connection to the individual great player. It's this excitement about this one-and-out tournament. Isn't that what it is?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, someone like you should be, you know, you should be pro work. And anyone who comes out of high school with a high school degree and wants to go to work and earn money to create a better life for themselves.
If they want to do it, I'm fine with that.
Right. So how about the kid from Everett who's forced to go to college for a year, goes to Kentucky, blows out his knee, now will sue the University of Kentucky and the NCAA because he probably has been cost millions of dollars because of that knee injury, because he went to school for that 1 year, because he had to.
Well, you know, that's the thing. That's the thing. You could get hurt. A lot of these guys obviously do get hurt. So,
Marjorie, look at poor Jimmy over there with the wrist bandage.
Well,
I mean, apparently he got
over.
No, but there's a serious
the computer, right?
Let's not share the story.
Chris Collins, please tell us. Let's share the sad story
about Jim Brady. For listeners that don't know,
go ahead.
Jim is about 6'5".
I am.
That's very tall.
220.
And well,
whatever. 240. It doesn't matter.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah, good. 255, maybe.
You tried out for your high school basketball team down in the mean streets of Philadelphia.
I did. Central High School.
And you actually made it to the last cut.
No, actually, I will. I forgot that. This is actually a great story.
Yeah,
true. Remember who Art McNally was? Art McNally was the NFL chief official.
The ref.
Right, and he was also my high school basketball coach. This is a totally true story. I went to Central High School. You know, you're a Philly high school. A lot of great.
Bill Cosby.
A lot of great. He went to Central as well.
That's right. Why do you think I mentioned it? Okay. I think I just threw something out there randomly.
So here's the deal. You know who also went there? Reverend, what's the Chicago reverend that got Barack
Jesse
Obama
Jackson?
So much
no,
trouble.
Not Jesse Jackson.
Oh, Reverend Wright. Reverend Wright.
Wright
went to Central High School.
He went to your high school?
He did, yeah.
Did you know him?
No, he was before me. But putting
Matter
this
fact,
aside.
Not only did he know him, Jimmy was in his church.
Here's what happened to me, and then I'm going to get back. We're going to get back.
6 points on the stop.
To March Madness. There are 15 players left. I'm a freshman on the high school basketball team. I was the worst of 15. I know it's hard to believe.
Hard to believe.
And I wasn't cut, so it's down to 14. I'm obviously still the worst. I'm not cut. It's down to 13. One more cut. Totally true story. Final cut, I am cut. And I go over to Coach McNally and I say, Coach, you know, I really appreciate the fact that you gave me an opportunity. And I was surprised that I lasted as long as I did. I said, how did I last this long? And he said, well, if you really want to know, Jim, the consensus of the coaches was, and these were his words verbatim, we couldn't believe that somebody this big could be this bad. So, back to March Madness. Chris Collins.
Now, Jimmy, yeah. I mean, you know I grew up in West Peabody.
I know that.
And there was a guy like you, 6'5", of your persuasion.
Dunk
was
over
a,
my
a,
head.
A dime a dozen. Okay, and you know what happened to them?
What's that?
They always first made their way over to the bench and took the stats. And then, you know what happened to them?
No.
10 years later, they were laughing at everybody because they were
they're
had
millionaires.
All the money.
Exactly. Okay. Back to March Madness. Who are the, because I don't even know this year, who are the four or five great teams? Last year, Kentucky was a prohibitive favorite. They ended up
that
winning.
That was obvious.
Okay. So who are the four or five great teams? Harvard. Is Harvard going to make it past the first round?
Harvard is not the Harvard you saw the last couple of years. A little bit down. Obviously, they won the Ivy League. But if you look at how they won the Ivy League, they lost two out of their last three, but Princeton lost like four out of the last five. So,
well, also a couple of the key players were suspended in the cheating thing, weren't they? So, I mean, they're down a couple of the big
players.
You always
got to go there, right? I mean, if you weren't from Penn, I bet you wouldn't mention the Harvard cheating scandal, but you couldn't get into Harvard, so we always throwing stones at
Charlie Baker mentioned yesterday the last time an Ivy League team was in the Final Four was Penn against Michigan State with Magic Johnson.
That was a Larry Bird Magic Johnson.
So, who are the four or five likely Final Four teams?
Well, listen, it's not like last year where everybody knew Kentucky, unless they did something drastically wrong, because they had five number one guys that they were starting, and they even had a number one guy basically coming off the bench. So it was kind of hard to beat that team. Kentucky is on the edge. They may not even get in. If they do get in, they likely will be one of the last at-large teams to get into the big dance. But if you're looking for a prohibitive number one, well, Gonzaga is the number one team in the land right now, but if you look at their schedule, because they're not from a major conference, so they haven't played any of the big boys really in about a month and a half, so I don't think anyone would say that's the best team in the country. But right under them is Duke. Indiana has been number one for many weeks this season, and those are teams that come from power conferences who are battle-tested, who fight every single game as opposed to fight one game and then take a month off. So I think you look at Duke, I think you look at Indiana, and you look at the Big East, Georgetown and Miami both have had terrific years. But the problem with the big conferences is if you go deep into your conference tournaments, which are mainly starting today, and you get beat up, and that typically happens in the Big East, it's hard to go into the big dance 100% healthy.
Our number is 877-301-8970. It's the voice of NECN sports guy, Chris Collins. Again, I want to hear, if you're one of the 38% who tell the truth and say that you watch some of the games at work, give us a buzz. If you gamble at work, by the way, you're not a big college basketball fan, but you don't join office pools at the Boston Herald?
I do.
Of course you do.
You do, of course you do.
I didn't know I was breaking the law.
That's what makes the numbers so big, because of people like Marjorie.
Non-gamblers do it.
I don't know what I'm doing.
They're not a gambler, they're not a sports fan, but you know, they start passing around those brackets.
Exactly.
And you feel like, well, I guess I'll do it.
Exactly. You haven't mentioned what you always mention, Jim.
Which is what?
The graduation rates of the people from Duke and Indiana and all these schools. Jim goes wild every year because...
No, it's not graduation rates. Derek Jackson in the Globe does this wonderful thing. I assume he'll do it where they pick the teams on Sunday night. And when's the competition start? On next Thursday? When is it?
Yeah,
Thursday. Okay, Derek Jackson always does this great column where he does the brackets of the 64, 65, 66 teams, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the graduation rates of African-American players, which often there's an inverse proportion between how great their basketball team is and what their graduation rate
is. Yeah, but he doesn't point out, someone like myself, I'm still working towards my degree. I mean, at some point I expect to fully get my associates.
You know, I shouldn't ask this question because I'm going to be embarrassed. How tall are you?
5'7", 5'8".
You probably can dunk or did dunk when you were a kid, could you not?
Absolutely. Well, you know what? My hands are small. Tennis ball. I could dunk a tennis ball.
Okay. Well, then maybe I could dunk
but
a tennis ball, too.
But he was a great baseball player, I understand, and is pretty good on the links as
well. But in all seriousness, great. Is there this not the same level of interest because you don't know the player? I mean, you may know the players.
I don't know why the average person doesn't know anybody. I don't know why you keep saying
Name three great college basketball players. You probably can't do it either.
I don't know why you keep saying the
He's
level of interest.
He's not answering the question because he doesn't know who they are.
Joe Malone's son.
The numbers that people are betting and the numbers as far as the TV ratings are not going down. I mean, you keep saying there's a disconnection because guys are leaving early, but the numbers are going up, and they consistently go up, and they go up because now
the gambling, that's why they go up.
Not just because of gambling, but I think now more than ever, because if you have a major college team, you're pretty much guaranteed that those guys are leaving after 1 year. So what does that do? It opens up the field to the VCUs of the world, to the Butlers of the world, because their kids, as high school seniors and freshmen in college, aren't quite as talented as what Kentucky is getting. So what does that mean? They stay in school for 2, 3, 4 years. So they learn how to play with each other. So you tell me, 4-year kid, you know, playing with his teammates for 4 years, let's say about 6 or 7 of them, taking on freshmen. Okay, guys are just come out of high school and just basically met each other a few months ago. You tell me who's going to win that basketball game.
Our number is 877-301-8970. You know, I want to clarify something.
Some things have never changed.
What's that?
I'm still educating you on the facts of the world.
Maybe you are. I want to clarify my position before, because I don't want people go. No, I'm serious.
Please.
You mentioned this thing that you said, you scoffed at me when I said I'm okay with kids who are freshmen leaving and going to the pros.
Because you've been complaining about
this
for years.
No, I have not. No, you misrepresent my position.
Here's my position.
If a kid gets drafted by the pros and ends up going, I mean, obviously they have freedom to make that kind of decision. I'm more concerned about the second tier players who go to these colleges, every one of whom, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris Collins, thinks they're going to be in the NBA. Maybe one of 100 on a major college team ends up in the NBA. They don't get a decent education because most of the basketball and football factories don't give a darn about whether or not that kid learns anything, but all they care about is that the kid can throw a pass, catch a pass, or can dunk the ball. Those are the ones who are in real deep you-know-what after 4 years.
I think you should ban March Madness.
Yeah.
I think that's the only answer.
All sports.
The only answer. He wants to ban that whole thing.
What I just described is a real serious problem.
But that's a different issue, though.
Yeah, it is a different issue. Problem, Jimmy, you're missing the problem as usual.
What is it?
The problem isn't when they come in, enter campus as freshmen. The problem is the enablers who have allowed these kids to come out of high school completely unprepared for college. If you get out of high school unprepared, I don't care how much work you're trying to put in. You're not going to make it. I mean, it's as simple as that. And the only reason at that point to keep somebody in school or on the floor is basically you're going to have to do what has been done to them for their entire life, whether it be an AAU coach or whether it be a high school coach. Somebody has clearly pushed them along. Because I think the majority of those kids are not coming in saying, well, you know what? I'm going to the NBA, even though they think they're going to the NBA, but I don't think they're like, well, I'm not going to do any work because I'm going to the NBA. Sure, there is a lot of them, but I don't think the vast majority. I think a lot of those kids come into high school or out of high school and into college completely unprepared, have no shot at completing a four-year degree.
Okay, we've asked everybody for the last week.
What do you mean? We know whose fault that is.
Oh, okay, fine.
I mean, Jimmy,
you're going to blame the teachers union?
Yes,
is that what you're going
to
do?
I mean, Jimmy, you just have to look at my background, and that hence the reason why I still do not have a four-year degree.
Actually, you went to the Great Temple University in Philadelphia, did you not?
I have a certificate of attendance.
No, is that true? I can't believe he's making this.
Okay,
you know what?
Listen, Jimmy's looking at me. I mean, the guy's known me forever. Now he's acting like he's been in my house. Now he's acting like I don't even have a degree.
Final episode of The Sopranos there.
I'm George O'Leary and I relied on my resume.
Yeah, Chris Collins. That's a big TV you got in that man cave of yours.
It's a whole wall.
I will tell you something about that TV. Only two type of people have that TV.
Yeah.
Either a professional athlete or somebody with a four-year degree.
Chris Collins, everybody who's called in about the Pope in the last week or so, we've asked them to make their prediction about who wins. Is it O'Malley? Is it Shearer, if that's how you pronounce it, from Brazil? What's his name from Milan? Whatever his name is.
Shearer. Isn't that the guy from the old show?
That's a different guy. That's our producer. Who's going to be the national champion at the end of this March Madness deal? Who's going to end up emerging, cutting down? I love when they cut down the nets, by the way. Who's going to be the net cutter down?
Right. Who's going to have what are we looking for? Light smoke? Or dark smoke?
White smoke.
We're looking for the white smoke. Who's going to have the white smoke? To me, you know, because it is open, it's so hard to pick against Duke. You know, there's something to be said about the kids that Krzyzewski is dealing with. I mean, he's only dealing with the top, not just basketball kid, but the top academic kid. It's so tough to be a smart team.
How many times have they won three or four championships? He's won three times.
And when he loses, it's because, you know, he doesn't have the athletes. This year, you know, if you look at his team, he's got the athletes.
Well, a star player. Didn't a star player just come back like a week ago, scored 37 points after he'd been inactive?
Think if Doc Rivers' kid had stayed and he'd still be on the team.
And he's gone to the pros.
Austin Rivers? How is Austin Rivers doing?
He's having a decent year.
Yeah.
So how about the hometown team? How does Harvard do?
I think Harvard this year, unfortunately, I mean, Tommy Amaker does a great job over there. And, you know, they've run off a couple of Ivy League titles in a row, but I just don't think they're as good as they've been in the last couple of years. You know, they're a little bit down.
When was the last time an Ivy League school won this big
thing? Won it?
Yeah.
Oh, it was probably I don't even think Bill Bradley won it.
No, Bill Bradley did not. Bill Bradley, though, Sports Illustrated just listed the 10 greatest performances
ever. What number was he?
Ever.
Seven?
He was in the top. I think it was seven, actually. What did he score? 59 points against Wichita State or something?
Yeah, they named the top 10 college basketball players of all time. Larry Bird was five. Bradley, I think, was seven.
Wow.
Number one was... the great Lewell Cinder.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, I remember him, UCLA.
Yeah.
Remember
you know,
him.
Also, you know what the incredible thing is about Bill Bradley? You know the old line about white men can't jump? I actually saw him play in college. He would get about an inch off the floor. He was relatively slow. He couldn't jump. One of the most electric basketball players. And then he went on to win championships with the Knicks.
And that full inch he would get off the floor, one full inch more than Jimmy can jump. Yeah, one full. Yeah.
Ay, ay, ay.
A full inch more.
Okay, Chris Collins, we appreciate it. Chris Collins, your prediction is once again due. By the way, if you can spell.
If you can spell Duke.
Coach Krzyzewski, we promise we'll invite you back at some point in the future.
Coach K.
Thank you very much.
Chris, one last Collins, one last question for me. How much money do you stand to be making if things go your way this March Madness?
Well, I hate rooting for Duke, but, you know, the money situation is an entirely different program.
Yeah, so. $200,000?
Hopefully enough to pay for my ticket that I got on my way over here.
Chris Collins, NECN Sports, we love you. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay.
He picks Duke.
Okay, we have been talking about March Madness with Chris Collins. Up next, we get an Episcopal priest's unusual take on this springtime basketball ritual with a twist. Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Author Katherine Patterson has a long list of young adult classics to her credit, but she began her career before her own children were old enough to read them.
A lot is going on in your head when you're changing diapers and doing all those things that have to be done.
Award-winning author Katherine Patterson shares her wisdom about writing next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting Tony Award winner Proof by David Auburn, running March 21st to April 14th. For more information, you can visit mrt.org. That's mrt.org.
You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us on the line is Father Tim Skink. He's the rector of the Episcopal Parish of St. John the Evangelist in Hingham, Massachusetts. But much more importantly, in the wake of talking about March Madness, he is the brains behind something called Lent Madness. Father Tim, thanks so much for being here.
A pleasure.
Great to talk to you, Father Tim. So tell people, what is, please, Lent Madness?
Well, it's the saintly smackdown, of course. We put 32 saints in a bracket, and throughout the season of Lent, they go at it.
Okay.
And now, and eventually we go through a number of different rounds, and eventually the winner is awarded with the coveted golden halo.
And do you award that yourself personally, Father Tim?
Personally, yes, indeed. I teleport. I crown them, and I come right back down. It's awesome.
Now, before we get to current events and who the contestants are, what today's matchup is, and how people can vote, is this your third year, fourth year? How many years have you been doing Lent Madness?
This is the fourth year for Lent Madness, and it's kind of gone viral, bigger than ever.
Well, we're going to talk about how it's gone viral in the Obama Labor Department in a couple of minutes. But before we get to that, who have worn the golden halo in prior years, Father Tim?
The first year we did it was 2010, and the 17th century poet and priest George Herbert won it.
Ah,
yeah,
I heard of him.
Yeah, the author C.S. Lewis actually won it the following year. Last year, in what seemed to be the year of the woman, Mary Magdalene swept through the bracket.
She
was great.
A much maligned woman, too. You're a priest, Father. She wasn't a hooker, was she?
No, she was not at all. This is one of these wonderful wonderful misconceptions that that we at Lent Madness try to dispel such things. And so what Lent Madness really is it's an online devotion for people to learn about the saints and also to have a lot of fun in the process.
You know, but when you say saints, we're talking to Father Tim Skenk, who is the man behind, the brains behind this terrific thing. I have to say I hadn't heard about till the other day, Lent Madness. Today's competition, every day there's a different matchup,
right,
is Martin Luther King Jr., versus Frances Perkins. Many people would not have heard of Frances Perkins, but she was the first Secretary of Labor. Was she the first woman ever in a cabinet for a president as well?
She was the first cabinet secretary, female cabinet secretary, and there is a Massachusetts connection with Frances
Perkins.
What's
that?
She is an alum of Mount Holyoke College.
Well,
that's
for
pretty
her.
Good. But that leads to my questions before we get to today's competition. How does one become a saint for purposes of Lent Madness? As far as I know, Frances Perkins may be a saint, small s, to a lot of people in the labor movement, but she's not a capital S saint, correct?
That's correct. You're not going to find a statue to Our Lady of Mount Holyoke, Frances Perkins, somewhere. But, yeah, so there are some standard saints that are recognized on the calendar. I mean, some of the ones in this year's bracket, you know, everybody's heard of St. Luke.
Yes.
Or they've heard of Saint Benedict, the name the previous pope took, of course, and so these Hilda of Whitby is another one. There's some of these wonderful saints that we've known about for generations. But then there are also people that are lesser known that are commemorated on our calendar, and those are some of the most fascinating stories because everybody knows about Saint Luke. Okay, he wrote the Gospel according to Luke. Great. But what people might not know about is someone like Janani Luwum, Janani Luwum. He was the Archbishop of Uganda who was actually personally assassinated by Idi Amin.
Oh.
And so there are some just fascinating stories embedded in here, and that's really the point, is to share some of these stories of some of these people that we all know and maybe learning something new and also learning about some of these lesser-known folks who can really serve as an inspiration in our own lives.
We're talking with Father Tim Skenk, who's the rector of the Episcopal Parish of St. John the Evangelist in Hingham, who's come up with this brilliant and very funny, fun game called Lent Madness. You know, there's a distinction. We've been talking about the Pope and the Papal Conclave mm-hmm. all day long. There's a distinction between a Catholic saints and, as some of the Catholics call the Episcopalians, near-beer Episcopalians saints. You guys have different and the Episcopal Church has different saints, right? Or do you just come up with these saints for Lent Madness?
Yeah, like, no, I just come up with them personally. No, I'm kidding. There is, of course, there's a tremendous amount of overlap, especially in the biblical and more ancient saints. But as we go on, there are people that we have on our calendar and that, say, the Roman Catholics have on their calendar that are separate. And we do throw some of these people in as well, because they're all great stories, and that's part of the whole spirit of Lent Madness, is it transcends just the Episcopal Church. It's really become much more ecumenical in nature. Now, I do have a little bit of a conspiracy theory regarding why why Pope Benedict the 16th retired.
Yes.
And that is, I'm pretty sure that he retired when he did, which happened to be on the very same day that his namesake, Benedict of Nursia, was in the bracket and defeated Anne, the grandmother of Jesus. But the theory is that he is now, has left the papacy so that he can manage Gregory the Great's Lent Madness campaign. Gregory is going to be up tomorrow, actually. And so we will see how that evolves.
By the way, what is the website for people
so
who want to be
play.
Able to vote? You do
yes.
not have to be a person of faith to vote, do you, or do you, Father Tim?
No, we do not card people at the door here. But it's www.lentmadness.org. And pretty much every day, certainly the weekdays of Lent, you simply log on to the website and you read about two different saints. And then you vote. One of the great things about this whole project is that it's really become kind of an online community in a sense. So, yeah, you can just go and vote, but hundreds and hundreds of people also then comment on why they're voting a particular way. And it's really fascinating. Some people have share really personal stories about why they voted a particular way, and some people just vote because maybe they're also named, I don't know, Martin.
So there is actually a method, if I may say, to your Lent madness. Is that correct?
That might be stretching it
a little bit.
But,
okay,
it is called Lent madness. It is not called Lent sanity. And so we get some of these upsets that you think, really? And so, for instance, earlier this month, John the Baptist, who you would think, everybody, he's got great name recognition, right?
Exactly.
John the Baptist.
Yep.
I mean, he's like he's like Jesus's fullback,
honey and locusts,
you know, and preparing the way.
Right.
And yet he lost to Saint Lucy, of all people. Now Lucy is the patron saint of eyes. Eyesight, I guess, and so I had no idea how many people were out there that voted for Lucy because they're suffering from, say, glaucoma. Just fascinating to me.
Well, can you stuff the ballot here? I mean, we know from things, some of the competitions on television, you can vote hundreds of times. Do you ask people on an honor system to only vote once? How do you do this, Father Tim?
Well, yes, we do ask people only to vote once. However, we are watching, and there have been several times there's been a little bit of voter fraud, not so much this year because we've been pretty strong about it, but last year there were a few votes that had to get zapped. I partner with a priest named Scott Gunn, who is the executive director of Forward Movement out in Cincinnati, and he's a priest who used to work for IBM, so he knows if you're voting more than once, and he will zap you.
Hey, Father Tim, I want to talk about two constituencies that may be upset with you. First is the Labor Department. There was a boomlet. There was an effort by a person in Obama's Department of Labor to get his employees to vote for Frances Perkins, the first woman Secretary of Labor. Tell us what happened there exactly.
Well, there was someone who, as a morale booster for his employees, encouraged people to go and vote for this little known in many circles, Frances Perkins, who they're very proud of over at the Labor Department. So, okay, perhaps that wasn't the greatest idea to do on a government computer. But on the other hand, it did put Lent madness in the realm of liberal conspiracy. And so I think that actually did bring some folks over. They also were, there was a an article that was, I don't know, kind of an expose about this on a very conservative website, and basically was accusing us, being Lent madness, of being basically an online gambling site.
Well, the humorless in the, I assume, in the religious community, and there are far too many, I'm assuming are not crazy about what you're doing either, right?
Well, yeah, most people that we come in contact with absolutely love Lent madness. They love the concept. It is clearly not for the humorless. And so they need not apply. As I often tell people, Lent madness is optional. You don't have to participate if you don't like it.
So,
and also, if this is your, you know, if this is your only Lenten devotion, well, you know, I'd encourage something else as well.
So today you're pitting Martin Luther King Jr. against Frances Perkins in the Lent madness competition. So do you know who's ahead at this point, Father Tim?
Shockingly, it is very, very close.
Last
I looked, Frances was down to Martin Luther King by only about 25 votes. So I would certainly, if you got a if you got a player in this one, I would go and vote at lentmadness.org.
Well,
I think some of it is the Mount Holyoke alums. Maybe it's Big Labor. I don't know. But Martin Luther King is certainly an icon and really a paragon of social justice. And some of the comments that you see, or a lot of people are saying, well, we already know about Martin Luther King. We think that Martin Luther King is terrific and saintly and all these things. But we want to learn more about Frances Perkins. And so the way that these rounds work is, in the first round, there is basic biographical information about the saints, just to teach everyone a little bit about them. The second round I call quirks and quotes, and so you will get quotes either by or about the saint in question. And then we like to hear what, you know, are there any quirks, any strange things about this person's personality that might just be interesting, like they only ate I don't know, venison on Fridays. Who knows what? And then the next round, which is perhaps my favorite, is the round of saintly kitsch. And so partly I came up with that because after the biographical data and the quirks and the quotes, well then what? So Google Images is our friend in this realm, and there's a lot of saintly kitsch out there.
I am hoping, Father Tim, though, that just like the Boston Herald and the Boston Globe edits out those comments which are inappropriate for readers, I'm hoping you or one of your colleagues serves a similar function. You do, correct?
Well, we do in a sense, although what's fascinating about this online community is I think it's unlike any other online community out there in that, at least at this point, maybe your listeners will change all this, but it's been very civil in the discourse and very respectful, and very, very few comments that are kind of off what you'd expect.
Well, Father Tim, you're handicapping all these saints day after day after day in Lent madness. Who are you handicapping for Pope? Who do you think has the inside track, Father?
Oh my goodness, I didn't know that I would get asked that question. Am I eligible for that?
I don't think the Episcopalians.
You're the 116th who's able to vote.
I guess my wife wouldn't really want to live at the Vatican with me in that role.
Yeah, no. Well, you know what's a wonderful thing about what you've done, Father, is that, you know, I think you have this idea, a lot of us do, that, you know, all the saints, they either had to be torn to pieces by lions or stoned to death, and all the women saints had to be virgins and burned at the stake. But you've got a big repertoire here. You know, Frances Perkins, Dorothy Day, unwed mother that she was. She got right in there, and your saint contest, I'm very happy about that.
Well, and this is the whole thing about saints, and one of the things that we really try to do is saints were real people. And so often, I think we immortalize them in statues and stained glass and oil paintings, but by doing that, we also immobilize them. And they were real human beings with faults as well. And they obviously did some saintly things, some heroic ways that they evidenced and witnessed to their faith, but they were real people like you and me.
Well, you don't know us, so you don't really know if we're real people like you, but we understand, Father Tim.
That was pure speculation. You're correct.
Hey, Father Timska, you are terrific. The website is, if you want to vote or want to learn something, is Lent, L-E-N-T, madness.org. Father Tim, we really appreciate your time.
A pleasure. Take care.
Thank you very much, and happy Lent to you, Father Tim.
Thank you.
You know, in a totally upbeat way, Father Tim has continued sort of the religious theme of today's show. We spoke to Chris Livesay at the start.
Yes,
we'll talk
we did.
To Chris again tomorrow. Obviously, mm-hmm. He's live from Rome from the Italian news agency ANSA. And by the way, obviously, if white smoke or black smoke had emerged from that chimney, would have told you, but it is yet to happen, and it's a little before 8 o'clock Rome time. Then we spoke to that Michelle Dillon from UNH, who was talking about what would happen if Cardinal O'Malley came back as an also-ran, but a very high-profile also-ran, and then Father Tim, why do you think the excitement, and I feel this, I'm a non-Catholic, as you know, I've been critical of Catholic hierarchy.
Hometown.
I am so
Hometown
into
boy.
This whole papal selection thing, it is surreal.
The website, Paddy Power, the betting website for popes, has Sean O'Malley fifth as of a few minutes ago, and we presume he's still there. Fifth in the betting right now. He's jumped up. Who
he
knows?
He was in the low teens, by the way, a couple of days ago at Paddy Power.
He's rising toward the top. Cardinal Sean.
In any case, if white smoke emerges, this is the place to be. WGBH, thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web 24/7 at wgbhnews.org/BPR. Tomorrow, the governor will be in the studio for Ask the Governor live from 12 to 1. Take our questions and yours. Chris Lydon will join us at 1 o'clock. Chris is on open mic, is going to talk about Rand Paul, that filibuster, and the whole issue about drones. We'll obviously give you papal updates throughout the show, but that's tomorrow. Again, the governor in studio, 12 to 1, to take all your calls, emails, those sort of things. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan, and thanks so much for listening.